طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر.
Good morning and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and continued in his memory by a group of his colleagues. This is John Roberts. This morning we will be talking about the plight of the Bedouins, nomadic tribes who live, among other places, in the Negev of southern Israel. They have lived and moved about freely on this land for centuries. But Israel is systematically taking their land for Israeli settlements. For the most part, the Bedouins have no title to the land. That has never been an issue until Israel declared itself a state in 1948 and is laying claim to all untitled land. The Bedouins are being herded into villages, some that are called recognized villages approved by Israel, but some created by the Bedouins that are not recognized and therefore not qualified for civil services such as water and sanitary services, and are vulnerable to ethnic cleansing and destruction. The Israeli government has adopted a new plan to resettle the Bedouin residents of the unrecognized villages in the Negev Desert into larger recognized settlements. This plan will affect tens of thousands of Bedouins in the Negev. Dressed up as a solution to the problem of unrecognized Bedouin villages, this plan, in fact, is a blueprint for ethnic cleansing and the destruction of the Bedouin way of life. As soon as Israel was established in 1948, it began a ruthless campaign of displacement and expulsion against the Bedouins, the indigenous community of the Negev, which had been living there for thousands of years before the establishment of Israel. Most of the community were expelled or forced to flee during the 1948 war. The remainder were forcibly relocated to a small area in the northeast of the Negev. However, Israel continued with its expulsion campaign well into the 1950s. At that time, Israel's Haaretz newspaper described how the army would drive the Bedouin off their land. Quote, "The army's desert patrols would turn up in the midst of a Bedouin encampment day after day, dispersing it with sudden bursts of machine gun fire, until the sons of the desert were broken and, gathering what little was left of their belongings, led their camels in long silent strings into the heart of the Sinai Desert," unquote. The Israeli government was determined to destroy the indigenous people of the Negev and turn it into an area for Jews only. On official Israeli maps, all the Arabic locality names were replaced by invented Hebrew ones. About 85% of the Negev was designated as state land. All Bedouin villages there were declared illegal and unrecognized. Being confined to a small, marginal area, The Bedouin were forced to give up their nomadic way of life, ceasing to move around with the herds. The Israeli government passed a law which made it effectively illegal for the Bedouin to graze their black goats, their most preferred and useful animal, and today the black goat is nearly extinct. In the 1970s, the Israeli government created 7 towns for the Bedouins, promising them access to basic services such as water, electricity, education, and health care. The largest of these was Rahat. Israel's true goal was to put an end to the unrecognized villages and gain more land in the Negev for Jewish settlement. About half of the Bedouin moved to these towns, while the other half refused to abandon their unrecognized villages, clinging to what was left of their traditional way of life. The towns are widely regarded as a failure, lacking essential services and infrastructure. The Bedouin today are the poorest and most disadvantaged community in Israel. Many lead a squalid existence, calling tin shacks home. 66% of them live below the poverty line and in the unrecognized villages. That figure reaches 80%. Under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli government has stepped up the campaign against the Bedouin as part of the wider campaign against the Arab community within Israel's 1948 borders, which has seen the targeting of leading Arab politicians such as Knesset member Hanan al-Zawabi and the passage of laws specifically aimed against the Arab minority. The new plan that has been adopted, known as the Prower Report, is being sold by the government as a way of absorbing the Bedouins into a wider society and improving their lives. Those resettled are to receive financial compensation, and the plan will cost the Israeli government $1.5 billion. However, on closer examination, the report's true intentions become clear. The Bedouin claim 600,000 dunams of land in the Negev, only 5% of the total area of their ancestral lands. They have continuously had this claim rejected by the Israeli courts. The original report of the Prower Commission estimated that the Bedouin were entitled to 187,000 dunams. That figure was reduced by the National Security Commission, to whom the report was presented, to 100,000 dunams. Under pressure from right-wing ministers in the government. Today, on average, a Bedouin farmer in the Negev possesses 3 dunams of land, while his Jewish counterpart possesses 30. The Prower Commission, which includes no representatives from the Bedouin community, was itself a replacement for the earlier Goldberg Commission, which included Bedouins and was seen by Netanyahu as too lenient. All this points to the ideological motivation behind the Netanyahu government's new policy towards the Bedouin. Informed by extreme right-wing Zionism, the government sees the Bedouin, the original inhabitants of the Negev, and the most powerless and disadvantaged community in Israel today, as an enemy and an existential threat. The development of the Negev, code for changing the demographic identity of the area, has become a preoccupation for the government, the Jewish Agency, and the Jewish National Fund. At the Negev 2010 conference in Beersheba, held in March of that year, senior ministers put forward a plan to attract 300,000 settlers to the area. One of them was the housing minister Ariel Atias, who previously said that it was a national duty to prevent the spread of Israel's Arab citizens. For his part, the chief executive of the Jewish National Fund in the United States said, "If we don't get 500,000 people to move to the Negev in the next 5 years, we're going to lose it," clearly referring to the Bedouin. In order to see the extent of the Israeli government's hostility to the Bedouin, one need look no further than the unrecognized village of Al-Araqib. This community, which has existed since the 19th century, has been demolished 29 times by the Netanyahu government, each time being rebuilt by its inhabitants immediately afterwards. These bloody-minded demolitions, aimed at forcing the inhabitants to flee in order to give their land to neighboring Jewish farmers, illustrate the true agenda of the Israeli government. If the Prower plan were to be implemented, all their villages would be destroyed. The Bedouin will not only lose their land, but also their livestock and what is left of their way of life. The towns they will be forced into, which lack essential services and infrastructure, and are ridden with poverty and crime, resemble ghettos more than actual cities. The identity of the Bedouin would be destroyed, and they would become outcasts in their own land. This plan brings to mind the forced relocations of the Native Americans in the United States and the resulting destruction of their communities. The Israeli government is trying to disguise its racism and rapacity behind a plan presented as being in the interests of a community, while its real intent is to destroy it and take over its land. One of those who is trying to support the Bedouins in their stand against the Israeli military, is Professor Oren Yifshatel. Oren Yifshatel teaches at Ben-Gurion University in Beersheba within the Negev. Professor Yifshatel is also president of the board of directors of the Israeli civil rights organization B'Tselem. He is working to find a solution, a just solution, for the Bedouins. And in fact, with his colleagues, has devised a plan that would allow the Bedouins to stay in their land and in their villages, if only the Israelis would comply. Professor Yifshatel spoke at the Tree of Life conference at Harvard University a couple of weeks ago. Here is a portion of his presentation addressing the Bedouin issue.
Well, thanks very much. It's dangerous to give a professor the time to be the last speaker. And I hope to try and pack my stuff in a lot of time. I'm very honored and very thankful for the invitation. The event is really touching. What George was bringing to us is, of course, the human tragedy that involved in all our speaking, all our analysis. And all of us are touched by it, one way or the other. You cannot escape living in Israel-Palestine, being touched by this enormous cost of the conflict. I want to thank David Good and Julius Atrash, especially because they organized my trip, and I'm very honored to contribute to this effort to bring justice and truth to our region through where we are really in the heart of empire, where things actually matter, what happens here. My background, like the other people have said, is quite similar. I'm also an Israeli for many generations. I'm born in Haifa, and so is my mother and my grandmother. It brings you a little bit of a different angle, being from the Galilee. But at the moment, well, for the last 20 years, I live in Beersheba, so it will be a peripheral perspective. And I want in my talk to try and use the opportunity that I'm speaking at a church, which is the first time I think I'm speaking at a church, and to weave my talk about the politics, about space, about the struggle, with also some of the divine texts that we are all using. And this is actually a very opportune time, because this time of the year, as you know, today's Erev Shabbat, today's Friday night, and every Friday night we read the Parashat HaShavua, which is the weekly reading through the whole Torah every year. And these few weeks are very, very important, foundational parashot, that is, tales, I suppose, or myths that we live upon. And this is all about the creation of the religions, the nations, and the land. And it so happened, it doesn't happen every year, but it so happened also last week was Eid al-Adha, which is the Muslim holiday about the sacrifice of Ismail, which is the parallel story to the sacrifice of Isaac, which is today Parashat Vayera. So it's very, very symbolic, very timely, and it doesn't happen every year. But I want to start by looking at last week's reading, which is about, it's called Lech Lecha. Like, go forth and walk. ויאמר אדוני אל אברהם, לך לך מארצך, ממולדתך ומבית אביך, אל הארץ אשר אראך. ועשך לגוי גדול, ואברכך, ואגדלה שמך, ויהיה ברכה. So, in the English translation that I have is, now the Lord said unto Abraham, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto the land that I will show thee. So from this beginning already, that land has become so important, that land that we struggle on, that land that this beautiful singer sang before, the Harat Amadayim, Ayun and I like it, Talhanu Kulayam. Every day we look at this land, Fairuz is singing, and this was here. And from the Abraham story, from the very beginning, he is sent there. But he said there, and a few other passages after that, he said, "Vayavo Avraham ba'aretz ad makom Shechem ad Alon Moed va'Knani az ba'aretz." And Avraham passed through the land and the place of Shechem, Nablus, and Alon Moed, and the Canaanites was then in the land. And this is really quite important. So the founding myth of all the modern nations, or not all the modern nations, but many of the modern nations and religions, which is Christianity, and Judaism, and Islam, because Abraham, the name, is the divine or the sublime father. Av is the father, Ram is very high, is actually going to a land which is settled. There are people there, right? And this is already debunking the myth of an empty land that we hear so many times. And one of Zionist myths from the 19th century is that it's a people without a land going to a land without a people, right? And this was wrong then, and it was wrong from the very beginning. And I think this should make us all quite humble, because it is really a foundational story about the creation of nations, that Muslim, Christian, and Jews abide by that, and it shows that all nations began in wandering. All were, in fact, moving from one place to the other. There's no one place that belongs only to one nation, and I think this is really a text of coexistence. You know, the very Parashat Lech Lecha, which is about moving and being accepted and living with others. But of course, these very same texts are quite often used in the opposite direction, more commonly. There are great, you know, the reigning in of a religion, internationalism, has meant that the stories are interpreted as exclusive ownership. This is our text, this is in Hebrew, therefore the land is ours and not yours. And this is, we heard all the time, we heard from the speakers before, from Iran and Maya, about militarism, which of course is very rife. But below that, there are even foundational myths about who the land belongs to and why do we need to be militaristic. It's because this is our promised land and not others. But the texts don't say that, right? And even when the texts say many times, I promise the land to you, it doesn't say that only to you, right? So we can, as educators, reinterpret the text. This is one of our responsibilities, that we can actually do that, and we are obliged to do that, and to show that this text actually can accommodate coexistence, as we should do politically and morally as well, but also to debunk the idea that the text the Jewish text and also some of the Islamic texts are never actually exclusive. They're not always pretty, but they always accommodate other peoples. So this is a preface to my talk where I want to touch on some aspects of the very problematic situation that we have in Israel, Palestine, and I want to highlight especially the situation among the Bedouins, which are quite often termed the forgotten Palestinians. But before that, I want to say that as the chair of the B'Tselem, which I should be just finished the position after 6 years, I echo a lot of what's said here before. We are in a very problematic situation because the situation in the West Bank and Gaza, and also inside Israel, but especially in the West Bank and Gaza, is deteriorating towards what I call in my studies, in my articles, creeping apartheid. That is, it's a colonial situation. That is, a state is going beyond its borders, beyond, you know, against international law. But it's not just occupation. I mean, George spoke so well about occupation, but it's more than occupation. Occupation is not enough anymore, right? Because occupation could be American occupation of Iraq, which is military, and it's temporary. And then they return the soldiers. We have something much more profound, which is a colonial process. That is, the settlers and all the apparatus around it is not there temporarily. They're there to stay, right? So this creates a situation, of course, of one law for one group, a lower law for another group, and all we know, but it's not declared. That's why it's written. It's institutionalizing without declaration. And I think this is a very dangerous situation. And one of my calls here for people to act, as I'm sure all of you are already doing, but to act more to prevent this situation. Because if eventually, and it could be after the next election, would more and more become an institutionalized apartheid, that would be very, very difficult to unpack. And it's, of course, much better to prevent it before, and it's still possible, although we are maybe in the 11th hour. What I want to touch on is then to tell you a little bit about the situation in the south. Half of the land of Israel, Palestine, is the Negev. Very little attention is paid to the Negev. And the situation there is very severe. Although the Palestinians in the south of Israel are Israeli citizens, and officially they have rights, more political rights than the West Bank, the situation in many ways, and Julius was with me a few times there, is worse than in the West Bank. The main problem revolves around the unrecognized villages, which is about 100,000 people, Bedouins, that live in on their ancestors' land, which they refuse to leave, in the worst conditions, worse than the refugee camps. They have no electricity, they have no roads, there's no water, very few of them have schools. They have some schools, but mostly they don't have schools. And this is supposedly with citizenship. And this is part, of course, of the Zionist-Palestinian conflict, manifests in a slightly different way, but not all that different to elsewhere. The Bedouins are the population in general that suffered the most in the Nakba. And in many ways, the Nakba is continuing. Three quarters of the Bedouins in the south became refugees. They are in Gaza, they are in the West Bank, they are in Jordan. So only about a quarter stayed in part of the southeastern corner of the country. And this is a very, very fast transformation. Only in the 1930s and 40s, the Bedouins were actually kings of the desert. They controlled it. They had their agriculture, they had their herds, they had their land system. They also controlled the Jordan Valley. But because they didn't register the land, which Dawood already said, it was very uncommon for the Palestinians to register the land. About 90% of them never registered the land. But the Bedouins must suffer a great deal from that, even though there were generations, long generations on the land, and nobody disputes that. Israel has used and manipulated the Ottoman and British legislation to create a situation, a ridiculous situation, where these people are declared trespassers to their own land. Okay? And this is happening all the time. I follow and advocate for these people in the West Bank and in the Negev. It's quite a similar situation, only there are many more in the Negev. And so you have all these villages that the state has declared that they're actually illegally occupying state land, because the state has declared that this land, because it wasn't registered, hold your breath, when did they have to register it? They had two chances according to Israeli law. In 1858 or in 1921. There were two chances to register the land. And once you didn't do it, in 2011, we tell you that you are a trespasser, right? This is how the law works, because of some legal doctrine that the previous law applies when there's no new law. And this is a ridiculous situation where the state actually tells these people, and you know there's 100,000 people, about 500,000 dunams that is at stake, that your parents didn't know about it, your grandparents didn't know about it, the British didn't tell you about it, the Ottomans didn't tell you about it, but we tell you that you are trespassing illegally on your land and we're going to take it from you. So this is why the villages all around Beersheba have this dire slum situation. I mean, I didn't know that there is a projector here, otherwise I would bring you examples, and all of you, of course, are welcome to come and help these people. And this is a situation where it resembles to some extent elsewhere with slightly different laws and regulations. But I want to talk about the resistance, and I want to talk about, much like Dawood was saying, is that we in the South, Jews and Arabs that believe in a joint future, we are not giving up. And in that respect, in the last 5 years, we started to do alternative planning. We started to actually produce professional architectural and geographical plans for these villages that show that they can stay, because the states want to evict them, and there's always new plans all the time. The government actually just recently approved another new plan to evict between 40 to 70,000. It's very vague what this plan says, but nonetheless, it is massive eviction into the towns. Israel provides towns for these people. Those that want to urbanize and have a block of land on an eighth of an acre with water and electricity, they can do it. This has to be said about Israel, to be fair to them. But most people are Bedouins. They're not interested in urbanizing, and they want to stay, and they have the right to stay on the land that was always their families. So we did surveys, we did workshops, we did aerial photograph. I'm also a geographer, so we used all the facilities that exist. We borrowed some resources from here and some from there, and we actually produced very recently an alternative plan for this whole region that shows that according to any planning principle, any democratic principle, all the villages can stay. Nothing will happen, you know? And we presented it in various conferences and to the government, and it embarrassed them a great deal, because all the time they said that there is no other way. A, legally, they're invading someone else's land, the state land, and B, those villages cannot stay, they all have to urbanize. And at the moment, this created a new conversation where it's on the media, it's in conferences everywhere, that a group of professional Arab and Jewish planners, actually, there is an organization called DIMCOM, which is a very good organization for doing alternative plans in Area C in the West Bank and in the Negev. And the government people are on the back foot. Now, I don't want to sound too heroic, because this plan has not been approved, right? This plan is an alternative to show, to strengthen the communities, to give them purpose, to give them some kind of horizon, but it's not approved. That is, the sword is still raised above their neck. And in that respect, it's part of the struggle. But it's a process of coexistence. It's a process of giving voice and giving presence to these people in places that were always non-existent. They were always absent. And in that respect, I want to say that it's possible to think of many ways to fight and to struggle against the colonial situation that we exist. Because the colonial is, obvious, stark in the West Bank, but it's also, I call it, internal colonialism, where the state is actually impinging on the minority, say in the Galilee and in the Negev, and we call it also in the scientific literature, internal colonialism. But it's a struggle. And like Dawood said so very well, this is not at all a place to give up. It's actually a time to continue in producing more and more of this kind of efforts, educating the people, producing documents, going to the court, not giving up. And even if you lose 9 times, the 10th time you might win. And this is where the situation is all the time open to struggle. The situation actually is improved to some extent because some of these villages started to be recognized. It doesn't mean much. They still don't have water, still don't have electricity, but at least they don't have 9 of them don't have any more the threat of being evicted from their land. So this little story just shows that with organization, with some resources that we badly miss, I mean, this is all still work by volunteers, we're looking for resources to make it much more professional, to actually have some professional lawyers also that will work with us, because these people are very, very weak. When they come to the court or the planning committees and they face 5 or 6 professional state lawyers, usually they lose, right? So this effort we very much want to continue and to present for every village, even with a building and architectural plan, and to actually issue alternative building permits. And this is not a joke. This year, in 2011, the past year, for the first time there were more house demolitions in the Negev than in the West Bank. There were 1,080 houses demolished in the Negev, right? And this is because of this process that I'm talking about. The state is trying to fight the minority to stay in its own land. So providing a system will actually help these people very much to hang on, help the Sumud, and help the idea that they have rights, because some other groups actually are articulating these rights and working with the communities. This time is a bit short. I was going to read from next week's Bible reading, which is about Hagar, and I will just tell you it's about, you know, Hagar Hajar, which is the mother of Ismail, and how she's thrown into the desert, and how she's saved, and how the story of Hagar actually tells us so many things about the possibility of resisting power, not giving up, and at the end, sometimes, not always, sometimes the power that we intervene on our behalf. And I join the recognition that the powers that be is us, right? The powers that can save us is us. And in that respect, I want to conclude by looking at a beautiful text, a poem by Mahmoud Darwish that you all know. But Mahmoud Darwish is usually known for historic, heroic, national, but he has some very, very interesting sort of human rights poems and very, very beautiful. One is called Fakir Bilirak, that is, think about others. And I think this will hopefully motivate all of you to act. As you fix your breakfast, think of others. Don't forget the pigeons to feed. As you fight your wars, think of others. Don't forget those who fight for the peace that we need. As you pay your water bill, think of others who drink the clouds rain. As you return home, your home, think of others. Don't forget those whose only shelter is their pain. As you sleep and count stars, think of others. There are people without any shelter to sleep. As you express yourself, maybe in university, in metaphorical expressions, think of others who have lost their right to speak. And as you think of others, think about yourself. وَبَعْدْ مَا تَفَكَرْ بِالْأَخِرِينَ فَكَرْ بِنَفْسَكَ. And think about how this world can be handled. And then say to yourself, I wish in this darkness I was a glowing candle.
That was Ben-Gurion University Professor Oren Yifshetel discussing the plight of the Bedouins in the Negev of Israel at the Tree of Life Conference at Harvard University. And now, with the time left to us, here is some news out of Palestine, Israel, as reported by the news service Mondo Weiss. There is an interesting story concerning Germany's commercial relationship with Israel. The story becomes all the more fascinating given the fact that Germany has become the preferred location of many Jews who are migrating out of Israel to find new homes. Why that is, given the history of the Holocaust, is anyone's guess. But the booming German economy, as well as Germany's record of reparations to the Jewish people, may play a role in promoting this migration. Now it is reported that Germany has nixed a deal to give Israel a 30% discount on a $1 billion purchase of German gunboats, allegedly to be used for the protection of Israeli offshore gas fields in the Mediterranean Sea. Reportedly, the Israeli National Security Advisor Joseph Cohen claimed Chancellor Angela Merkel made an explicit promise to subsidize the purchase of the gunboats during a joint meeting between German and Israeli cabinets last February. But his counterpart, Merkel's National Security Advisor Christopher Huisgen, denied that that ever happened. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, Huisgen told Cohen that there was no chance Germany's parliament would approve the deal given the breakdown of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, which has been blamed at least partly on Israeli settlement construction. For anyone following the trajectory of German-Israeli relations, this is long overdue. Back in 2009, at a press conference in Germany during Netanyahu's first official visit after being elected prime minister, Merkel emphatically called for a full halt on settlement expansion. This was after Cohen's predecessor, Uzi Arad, had demanded Merkel not even mention settlements during the press conference lest Netanyahu threaten to cancel the visit. Later that same year, Germany had tried influencing the U.S. not to oppose the Goldstone Report at the U.N. as a ploy to pressure Israel into complying with a settlement freeze, as revealed by a leaked cable from the U.S. Embassy in Berlin. At the time of the leak, in 2010, the Jerusalem Post reported the WikiLeaks disclosure is said by some in Germany to reveal profound cracks in the special relationship between Israel and Germany. Fast forward a few years, and media reports out of Germany have echoed sentiments that these profound cracks were widening, indicating the diplomatic relationship between the two countries was deteriorating. Reports such as DW's A Turning Point in German-Israeli Relations notes, German public opinion of Israel is on a nosedive. Only 14% of Germans have a positive view of Israel and characterize the relationship as the worst crisis in diplomatic ties since Merkel took office nearly 10 years ago. Published on the eve of Merkel's 2014 disastrous press conference in Israel with Netanyahu, and less than 2 weeks after EU President Martin Schulz's speech at the Knesset caused an uproar that reverberated in Germany and throughout Europe, but was ignored altogether by the U.S. press, the delay in any meaningful resolution between Israel and Palestine looms large. Let's review what went down last February while Merkel and her cabinet were visiting Israel. Quote, "We are looking at the settlement issue with grave concern," Merkel said at a news conference with Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. "We hope it will not stand in the way of a two-state solution and that we can overcome it," unquote. Merkel reiterated that Germany adhere to the EU position on settlements, which under guidelines published in July prohibits financial dealings with settlement-based entities. Does that square with Merkel making an explicit promise to subsidize an Israeli purchase worth hundreds of millions of dollars with no quid pro quo? And what does it mean that Germany adhered to the EU position on settlements under guidelines published last July? We reported at the time, the new European Union directive had a territorial clause banning all EU funding of projects in territories occupied by Israel since the 67 war. Are gunboats supporting settlement expansion? Merkel has stated Germany, quote, does not support boycotting, unquote. But what about supporting Israel attacks on fishers in the Gaza Sea? Israeli naval forces continue to carry out attacks on Palestinian fishermen in the Gaza Strip in April, including 11 shooting incidences, three chasing incidents that led to the arrest of two fishermen and confiscation of two fishing boats and fishing equipment, 22 pieces of fishing net belonging to Palestinian fishermen in the Gaza Strip. Although on the 21st of May, 2013, Israeli authorities limited the fishing distance in Gaza to 6 nautical miles, they neither complied with that distance nor allowed Palestinian fishers in the Gaza Strip to sail and fish freely and continue their attacks against them. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights documented all the attacks carried out within the distance of 6 nautical miles, which proves that Israeli forces policies aim to tighten restrictions on the Gaza Strip's fishers and their sources of livelihood. Israel's attacks against Palestinian fishermen, who do not pose any threat to Israeli soldiers in the Gaza Strip, constitute a flagrant violation of international humanitarian and human rights law relevant to the protection of the civilian population and respect for its rights, including every person's right to work and the right to life, liberty, and security of persons, as codified in Article 3 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and Article 6 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, despite the fact that Israel is a state party to the covenant. Furthermore, these attacks occurred at a time where the fishers did not pose any threat to the Israeli naval troops, as they were doing their job to secure a living. Israeli violations in the reporting period were as follows. During the reporting period, Palestinian Center for Human Rights documented 11 cases in which Israeli forces fired at Palestinian fishers at sea off the Gaza Strip. As a result, fishers were forced to flee and leave the sea in all attacks. It is noted that all these incidents happened within the 6 nautical miles allowed for fishermen to sail and fish in, according to the ceasefire agreement concluded between Israel and the Palestinian armed groups under Egyptian and international auspices. What if the new German gunboats are primarily used to attack these fishers? Maybe Germans are just fed up with that. And finally, as evidence that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is sticking in the craw of Israeli officialdom, we have this concluding story. Ronald Lauder, the president of the World Jewish Congress, has harshly attacked Danny Glover after the Hollywood star affirmed his support for the cultural boycott of Israel. Lauder accused Glover, famous for his roles in Lethal Weapon and other movies, of fanning the flames of anti-Semitism in America. Glover is featured in the documentary about legendary activist Grace Lee Boggs. Lauder's criticism came after Glover and others in the film released a pro-boycott statement after they found out that the documentary entitled American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs, is set to screen at an Israeli government-sponsored festival. Glover said, "We stand in solidarity with the people of Palestine and support their call for cultural and academic boycott of Israel. We immediately took action to have the film withdrawn from the festival. The festival's organizers and film producers informed us that this was not possible and they would move forward with the screening over our objections. This film uplifts the life work and legacy of Grace Lee Boggs. She has explicitly stated her support of the boycott and believes this screening is in direct contradiction to her legacy and ongoing work as a revolutionary," Glover said. Hours after the statement was made and spread to Israeli media, Lauder published his swipe at Glover in his capacity as president of the World Jewish Congress, an international group that dubs itself as the diplomatic arm of the Jewish people. Lauder said, "Danny Glover supported a boycott of Israel in 2009, and it therefore comes as no surprise that he does not wish the movie to be screened in Israel. We call on America's film industry to speak out against the growing campaign to boycott the Jewish state. Just like anti-Semitism, unfair criticism of Israel should be condemned." In recent months, Lauder, who used to be one of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's major backers, has become increasingly vocal about the need to defeat the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live at www.wzbc.org. Or listen to us at any time via the WZBC archive found on the home page. Simply click on archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.